On this week's 51%, New York now allows the use of campaign funds for childcare.
The first question that you get asked as a mother with young children is, what will you do with your kids while you're campaigning? Who's watching them? And that's infuriating.
Hear from a gymnast who went viral and find out what one local chapter of the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence are up to these days. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good. Dragonfly out in the
sun. New York has become the 12th state that allows childcare to qualify as a campaign expense. Governor Andrew Cuomo signed the legislation July 30th, saying it is another step toward gender equality and will empower more parents, especially mothers, to seek public office. Democrat Yuba Gretchen Shirley's children were ages 1 and 3 when she launched her campaign against Republican Congressman Peter King on Long Island in 2018. She petitioned the Federal Election Commission and became the first woman to receive federal approval to spend campaign funds on child care. And she applauded the new law in New York.
This is a major breakthrough, and it'll get more women running for office.
She is the founder of a PAC she launched in January called Vote Mama, supporting Democratic mothers with young children running for offices from school boards to Congress. She says many women wait until their children are grown to run for office.
You know, you look at Nancy Pelosi, she waited until her youngest child was 17 to run. And we have, at the federal level, women don't get into leadership positions until they're usually in their 60s. And it's frankly because they wait till their children are grown. By the time we're 44 years old, 88% of American women are moms. So if we're not supporting getting moms to run, we're actually not supporting the vast majority of American women. And what we're doing with Vote Mama is we are mentoring, we're training, we're endorsing, and we're funding these incredible moms who are running up and down the ballot across the country. And we're continuing to grow. We launched at the end of January. We've already had over 170 applications for moms running in 26 different states. We've endorsed 35 already, and we've had 11 wins so far.
It's almost like political planning is part of family planning. When am I going to have the kids? When will that enable me to run for office? It's almost like you have to put off and plan running for political office with family planning if that's your goal in life.
It's true.
Right.
It's absolutely true. One of the women on our advisory committee, Assemblywoman Michaela Solange, she was just telling us the other day that on her first day in the Assembly, a more senior elected official told her not to get a dog. This was the person's advice. Don't get a dog and don't have children. And this person told her that you cannot be a mother and a good legislator at the same time. And I'll tell you from personal experience, the first question that you get asked as a mother with young children is, what will you do with your kids while you're campaigning? Who's watching them? And that's infuriating because until recently we had 3 men running for president with 8 children under the age of 10. 2 were infants, and no one was concerned about their children. Everyone just assumed that there was a partner at home taking care of them. But women, when you run with small children, you face different barriers. Donors don't take you as seriously. Voters don't. The press doesn't. And people are concerned that you will be able to juggle both. And at the same time, in the past, women ran as mothers. They just hid who they were as moms. They didn't talk about their children. They didn't bring their children with them. So we are, with Vote Mama, we are working to make it the norm that women can step up and run when they're ready, not when society tells them they're ready. We want to make it the norm that people run with young children and not the exception.
Westchester County Democrat Shelley Mayer sponsored the bill in the Senate. She mentions the inspiration of Gretchen Shirley, saying it was important to pass state law rather than rely on a ruling that could be overturned.
And I think by having it in the law, you're going to encourage, as they say, people to say, maybe I could run. I would say myself, I chose not to run as a young parent, in part because I was discouraged by other women in elected office, that it was just too hard having young children.
She says adopting such an attitude does not have to be the norm.
And I can just tell you, having been around Albany for a long time, that having the voices of new parents, particularly young mothers, come and speak with passion about the issues that they face has added so much to the dialogue. And that's going to be the case everywhere.
Manhattan Democrat Linda Rosenthal sponsored the bill in the Assembly. She says an aspect of New York's legislation that allows campaign funds to go toward child care expenses for elected office holders as well as candidates appears to be a first.
Particularly mothers are in charge of child care. And if they're elected officials, we shouldn't have them choose between spending their entire salary on child care or doing their job properly.
Rosenthal underscores that the funds used for child care are not from taxpayers.
This is money that candidates raise from their supporters, and their supporters know or should know what the money that they are donating goes toward. So you assume it goes toward advertising and mailers and phone calls and other campaign expenses. So they just need to know that now this kind of funding can also go to child care, all in the service of having the candidate and the elected official do a great job.
Gretchen Shirley mentions other states that permit the use of campaign funds for child care expenses.
Those who have already approved it, Alabama, Arkansas, Texas, Wisconsin, Kentucky, Utah, the list goes on. It's pretty incredible. Actually, there is a woman named Morgan Lemondre. She's running for a state seat in Baton Rouge. She actually put a request in to the Louisiana Ethics Commission back last November. And while they had approved it for four men in the past, they said no to her. And there's a recording. You should listen to this recording. There was an older man that said to her that she had misplaced priorities and that her primary responsibility was to take care of her children. And we helped her with the appeal process. I wrote a letter of support. We talked her through the appeal. She won her appeal, and Louisiana is now one of the 12 states that has approved the use of campaign funds for child care. New Hampshire and California are about to become the 13th and 14th. If the bill has passed their state assembly and Senate, and they're just waiting for the governors to sign those two.
In New York, the bill's provisions become effective 60 days after signing. Congress is considering whether to provide more benefits for service members and veterans whose war injuries left them infertile. Currently, the military pays for in vitro fertilization only in limited circumstances. And a VA program that provides fertility coverage for some veterans is scheduled to expire later this year. Carson Frame reports for the American Homefront Project.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Army veteran Jason Gibson lives with his wife, Kara, and daughter, Quinn, in central Ohio. They spend a lot of their days coloring and playing hide and seek.
10, ready or not, here I come.
For the Gibsons, family life hasn't come easy. In 2012, in an IED blast in Afghanistan, Jason lost both legs and suffered shrapnel injuries to his groin.
Do you remember how Daddy got hurt?
Stepped on a bucket.
He stepped on a bomb.
No one in the military health system talked to the Gibsons about possible fertility problems until a year later.
We were meeting with his nurse practitioner, and all of a sudden she just brought up, "Hey, have you guys gotten a sperm count yet?" And the thought just never crossed our mind. We just kind of assumed that everything would be okay.
Jason's sperm count was practically nil, and it didn't improve. The couple was told they had no chance of conceiving a child naturally and would need to rely on uterine insemination methods, or IVF. Still, they received little support from the military and its insurer, TRICARE.
TRICARE would cover, like, IUI, and they would cover some of the IVF medications, but when it comes to the actual procedure, egg retrieval, sperm retrieval, freezing of embryos, they don't cover that.
In 2014, after Jason was medically retired from the Army, the Gibsons paid for IVF mostly out of pocket, shelling out more than $10,000. Quinn was born 9 months later. Since then, the situation has improved somewhat. In 2016, Congress directed the VA to cover IVF for people whose fertility problems are service-related. But that can be difficult for couples to prove. And funding for that VA program is uncertain. Congress has been approving it 1 year at a time, meaning it could go away as soon as the end of September. Senator Patty Murray of Washington State wants to make it permanent.
Although we have passed a form of this bill in our yearly appropriations bills, it has caused a lot of confusion to our veterans, and that's why I have reintroduced this bill as permanent and defined it so specifically.
Murray also wants the VA to cover more types of treatments and offer them to more kinds of veterans, including non-traditional couples and those who need donor sperm or eggs. Her bill would also require the VA to pay for the cost of adoption for veterans with service-related infertility. But the cost of Murray's bill has been a roadblock, and so have religious objections. Gynecologist Kathleen Raviel is past president of the Catholic Medical Association. She says they support veterans, but oppose IVF.
It takes away from the couple having the child. It puts it into the laboratory. So the lab technician chooses the embryo, or the embryos, maybe one, two, or three embryos will be implanted in the woman. The rest may be discarded, and these are human lives.
Senator Murray takes issue with that.
To them, I say, go talk to these men and women whose one dream is to have children and to have a family, and then ask yourself if you should impose your religious beliefs on them.
And where's my pink crayon? Oh, there it is.
Now that the Gibsons have their family, they say they feel lucky, but they still think of other service members returning from war and hope that the government moves fertility higher on its list of priorities.
There's this old saying that goes that if, you know, the military would have wanted you to have a family, they would have issued you one. And I've just kind of always felt that's how it's been. I mean, things, like, have improved, but at the time, we just kind of felt last.
I don't know what colors are in a rainbow.
We need red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and...
This is Carson Frame reporting.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Later in August, Albany, New York will be the center of women's sports when the first Aurora Games come to town for 5 days. Female athletes from the United States and around the world will gather for the Games, inspired by the Olympics and named in honor of the Roman goddess of the dawn. And a gymnast who went viral earlier this year is one of the major attractions. 51%'s Ian Pickus reports.
Caitlin Ohashi became known as the Perfect 10 due to her flawless performances on the floor and balance beam, and graduated from UCLA this spring as a 10-time All-American. Her perfect floor routine has been viewed millions of times online. During the second day of the Aurora Games, which start August 20th at Albany's Times Union Center, gymnasts from Team World will compete against those from Team Americas. Ohashi, now 22, spoke on a conference call.
It's a different side to gymnastics because typically there aren't, like, pros, and it's not something you can do after college. So this event is just a really cool opportunity for especially gymnasts, I would say, but everyone.
It'll be a reunion of sorts for Ohashi and longtime Bruins gymnastics coach Valerie Kondos Field, who gave Ohashi a fresh start in college after she confronted body shaming while rising through the gymnastics ranks.
I am proud of the example that she's showing to other people, especially young girls, that you don't have to be so myopic to be great at something.
Miss Val just retired from UCLA after nearly 4 decades on the coaching staff and 7 national titles. At the Games, Kondos Field will administer the gymnastics competition.
Whether it's social media or whether it's just how we all grow up, girls can be mean. And when you see any time I've been a part of something like this, like I said in my opening statement, women supporting women, there's an energy and a love that comes out of this that has not even an inkling of jealousy or mean girl spirit. And it's super important for especially young girls to see girls supporting girls.
Ohashi says the Aurora Games will be her farewell to competition after her stellar college career. But gymnastics wasn't all she focused on at UCLA.
I mean, honestly, I went to college to learn, and I think I did that and, like, just experience life. So I would say I'm trying to change the world and do kind of everything that makes my heart and soul sing.
Whatever happens in Albany, Ohashi expects to be busy afterward.
My plate's pretty full right now, so I have been pretty busy with speaking engagements and just, like, traveling all over. I have my September decently full, and then I will continue on with all that speaking engagements. I am going to try and write a couple books.
Basketball, hockey, and tennis are among the other sports that will be part of the Aurora Games. For 51%, I'm Ian Pickus.
Forget silent auctions, chocolate bars, and raffles. fundraising can be more fun with nuns. At least nuns dressed in drag, dancing, joking, singing, and cajoling until you part ways with your money for a good cause. KFAI's Matthew Schneeman shares a story of a local chapter of rowdy nuns in Minnesota.
For KFAI in Minneapolis, I'm Matthew Schneeman. I'm at the Cambria Gallery, normally a marble showroom for renowned interior designers, but tonight, a self-described razzle-dazzle gaggle of drag nuns is the main attraction. These nuns call themselves the Ladies of the Lakes. Their mission? Promulgate joy and expiate stigmatic guilt.
My name's Utterly Fabulous.
I'm Sister Gaia Day, and that is because a Gaia Day keeps the doctor away.
Yeah, I'm Sister Luna Love a Good Time.
Well, I'm Sister Kimbucha with the Ladies of the Lakes.
And the Ladies of the Lakes is Minneapolis's chapter of the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence.
It's true. Well, my name's Gertie Rotunda, and I'll tell you a little bit about the sisters here. We got started in 1979 on Easter Sunday back in San Francisco. Ding, ding. That's right. A bunch of men went out in drag to raise awareness for HIV/AIDS. That was the beginning of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, 1979. And the public just fell in love with them. They got their point across. And since then, they have been doing activism.
Activism and more. They host events, they show up at fundraisers, and perform at drag shows. All while dressed as nuns. Well, more like nuns' night out. Usually, their faces are painted white with bright makeup on top, green contoured cheekbones, blue-dyed beards, and crazy long lashes. Each sister dressing as they please, but unified with a headpiece shaped like the O from LOL, Ladies of the Lakes.
I am Sister Brenda Rehab. That's Brenda Lotta Rehab, actually. 1,000 years ago, when I was in the military and stationed in San Francisco, I saw the sisters for the first time. And that was back before even Don't Ask, Don't Tell, so there was no chance of becoming one. But it was just magical. Glitter, floaty, just almost ethereal, that whole feeling of joy, which is what the sisters are all about. I mean, who can't feel magic in the presence of a 6'2" drag nun with glitter lips?
With her is Sister Utterly Fabulous.
I mean, when you see a group of us walking down the street, it kind of, I mean,
scares you to death.
it can scare you to death, or I think you feel a multitude of emotions when you see someone like us out in public. But most of all, we're here to promulgate universal joy and expiate stigmatic guilt. That's our mission statement.
At another bumping venue called Lush, two of the sisters hosted a fundraiser for All God's Children. Here's Tammy Gay Bakery, named after Tammy Faye Baker, televangelist from the 80s.
Tammy Faye is from Minnesota. She's born and raised in International Falls. Myself having a background in church work, I find a lot of the stuff that the sisters do is very complementary to the stuff that I used to do when I was a youth pastor. And I think that's something that we have to do as sisters is show people that you have inherent worth because you are a loved being.
How long have you been a sister?
Well, my name is Sister Jiz Taylor.
Your makeup is gorgeous too.
Thank you. Thank you for the compliment, my friend.
I just want to stay her rich.
Wait.
Outside on the patio, before the show, a patron, relaxed in the chair, voiced their approval. I walked over.
And she has on a nice outfit. Jay Taylor, all right. Ooh, nice shoes. You show them legs off, honey. Yes. Yes.
One. It's for charity. Donate. Tip us, there's two buckets on the side of the stage, and we're not here to pick up your dollar.
Jiz Taylor and Tammy Gay Bakery performed and emceed the fundraiser and helped raise over $4,700 for All God's Children. And that motto they have?
And then we can do our mission, which is to spread joy and expiate stigmatic guilt.
And as I watched Jiz Taylor roll about in a bright red jumpsuit to It's Raining Men, simultaneously taunting and flirting with the crowd, I thought, yeah, joy promulgated. For KFAI, I'm Matthew Schneeman.
Next, we bring you a story about music as medicine.
Andrea Cortez is a music therapist from Austin, Texas, who integrates the science of sound and spirituality into her practice. Andrea Cortez is not a healer. She's a therapist. But in a rational world, music is her medicine. While attending Colorado State University, her longing for home led her to pursue a deeper relationship with music, which was further transformed after connecting to traditional Mexican music from Oaxaca.
The sort of gap or emptiness that was left in my life because of all the culture and family that was here in Austin wasn't there in Fort Collins, and I missed it for the first time. I think that when I moved there, I started to feel myself identifying as Mexican-American and Tejana. So when I went to school, actually, voice was my main instrument. I was learning songs, Western classical music, learning how to sing in German and Italian and French and classical style music from the West. I didn't feel connected. It wasn't until I left school and I went to Oaxaca and I sang those songs. And then my voice came out. My voice was stronger and freer and more expressive. And so I think that was the time.
As both an accomplished musician and board-certified music therapist, Andrea lets her intuition lead her practice.
I think in my life I've always explored further because I want to go to where I'm interested in. I want to learn from other ways. If I can find some value that's very deep and meaningful to me, then I want to incorporate that and use that.
After studying Indian classical music in Austin for 2 years, her close relationship with her Guruji further deepens her therapeutic practice and understanding of the role of music as medicine.
You know, Guruji tells me, he's like, you are my library. I am storing all of this knowledge in you. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you know what that means? For him to say that, that's huge. That really means a lot to me. So, my teacher, Ustaji Nizami, he comes from a lineage of musicians who practice healing through music for 17 generations of Sufi musicians. He always gives me lessons too in this aspect of music. It's not just like, okay, here's a song you're gonna learn. He gives me stories and stories of like, this is what the song means and this is the background of it. And this is the respect that you need to have. He teaches the whole cultural, it's all there packaged. It's not just, he's not just about music. And he looks into the audience when he plays and he assesses who needs what. And he's like, he'll tell me, this person may need this rag. They may need this scale. And this person, he may need this tal, which is the rhythm, or this count, and this person may need really upbeat fast, and this person may need something slow and very sweet melody. So he looks at the people he identifies and he knows. When I was studying and learning the music from Mexico and from my family, that was making me stronger. But then now that I'm studying this music in a completely different language, in Urdu and Hindi, How am I connecting with this? I don't know, but I am. And I don't really know how to explain that, but that because I connected first to my own roots, that I was able to then flourish out. I think maybe that's what it is.
Music This story was produced by Gabriela Garza and Alamgir Lalani, with assistance from Carlos Salazar, for Stories from Deep in the Heart, a project of Texas Folklife.
This is Bird Note. In a children's hospital in Liverpool, England, the sweet sounds of birdsong carry along the hallways. It's a recording of the dawn chorus from a nearby park, and the intent is to calm the anxious young patients. This hospital is one of a number of places in Europe where birdsong recordings are used to foster an uplifting and therapeutic experience. Research does show that natural sounds can help relieve stress. Where some noises like TV, traffic, and random conversation make it hard to concentrate, the songs of birds may make it easier. One expert thinks that birdsong relaxes people physically while stimulating them cognitively. The body relaxes while the mind becomes alert. Institutions have begun to put this logic to work. A primary school in Liverpool played a soundscape of birdsong and other nature sounds after a lunch break, when students would normally be drowsy. This appeared to help them concentrate and become more alert. And birdsong is now used at Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam, where a lounge plays bird sounds to help travelers relax before flights. So if you're feeling stressed out, try playing a bit of birdsong. Or better yet, step outside and listen to the real thing. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1568.